Hello, everyone. This is Future Jen recording, and I just felt like I needed to add a little note to this podcast before we get started into it. I can't speak for Ellen, but for me, I've been going through a lot at work. We've been doing a lot of overtime, and I feel like my brain has been very tired and my body has been very tired. Hence, I feel like some of the more awkward, wobbly nature that may be present in this podcast. Also, the part where I mentioned about the disaster movie scenario, it's not in this book. It's just something that I invented to express how the book made me feel and the feelings that it sort of brought up for me. And also like how I feel about, some of the issues that the book talks about. And I don't think that was clear. I was really struggling to express my thoughts a lot of the times during this recording. So, I wanted to just express that, and I hope you still enjoy it. I did the best I could with the editing. This is part one. We have two more parts, and I am determined to try to make the next part or the next two parts a little more clear. And I think also, like, I didn't have enough time to process some of my thoughts. And the thoughts in this book and the ideas in this book are so big and complex that I really needed to, like, be able to sit down and think about it a little more. I just didn't have the time. So going forward, hopefully it'll be better. And also, hopefully, you're your own worst critic. Hopefully it's better than I thought it was. Usually it is. But I just felt like, again, now I'm repeating myself. I just felt like I needed to sort of add a clarification onto some of this. So, but I hope you enjoy it. It's an amazing book that we are reading. Amazing, scary, amazing, inspiring, amazing in so many ways. And, if anyone's interested in any of these topics, I would definitely recommend reading it, even though, like, sometimes it's very heavy, but it's just, he's got, Paul Kings North has a way of cutting through a lot of the bullshit to sort of laying out and explaining in a way that I have not had it explained to me what sort of the situation seems to be with, regards to like climate change, our planet, people's relations to nature. And it really like, it's like somebody sort of put into words a lot of the feelings that I've had for many years. And that is always cool. You can be like, yes. This is exactly how I was feeling and thinking, but you've put it so eloquently, eloquently. Okay, so enjoy, and I will chat at you later. Oh, wait, one more thing. We are going to once a month, and I'm sure I'll talk about that during the next podcast at the beginning, probably as well, due to life circumstances, other things. But I hope to have something additional to add into that second slot. So there will be something else at some point, besides just the one podcast or a month. Okay. Hello, I am Jennifer Braverman.
And I'm Ellen Selm.
And welcome to our podcast, Stories from the Earth,
where we explore mankind's relationship and connection with the natural world.
We would like to take a quick moment to invite our listeners to consider supporting us through a humble little donation. You can go to our anchor page and click the $1, $5, or $10 a month option. And this goes to supporting us with future projects, such as launching our herbal educational curriculum we have dubbed the People's Herb School, as well as funding to help take the show on the road and do some on-site reviews and interviews at herb farms and herb conferences and schools and other interesting places relevant to our podcast.
Today we are starting a chat review of Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist and Other Essays by Paul Kingsnorth. This book has a lot of discussion-worthy subject matter, so we're going to be covering it over the course of a couple of episodes, and today is part one. A bit about the author. Kingsnorth is originally from southern England, and he now resides with his family in Ireland. He was the first in his family to attend university and educated in modern history. During that period, he became involved in the Dongas Road protest group sites in East London, and after chaining himself to a bridge alongside 50 others, Kingsnorth was arrested, and it was an event that solidified the importance of protest for him. At Oxford, Kingsnorth edited the university's long-running student newspaper. With this background, he started working at the comment desk of The Independent in 1994. He found that work was frivolous and uninspiring, so after less than a year, he left to join the environmental campaign group called Earth Action. He subsequently worked as commissioning editor for Open Democracy, as the publications editor for Greenpeace, and between 1999 and 2001 was the deputy editor of The Ecologist. He's named one of Britain's top 10 troublemakers by the New Statesman magazine in 2001. And in 2020, he was called England's greatest living writer by journalist Aris Rusino. Kingsnorth announced retirement from journalism in 2007. In 2009, with writer and social activist Dugald Hind, Kingsnorth founded the Dark Mountain Project, which is described as a network of writers, artists, and thinkers who have stopped believing the stories that our civilization tells itself. He traveled through Mexico, West Papua, Genoa, and Italy, and Brazil, and wrote his first book in 2003 called One No Many Yeses. The book explored how globalization played a role in destroying historic cultures around the world. His second book, called Real England, was published in 2008, and he reflected on how some of those same forces of globalization affected England, his own country, and the homogenization of the culture. He's contributed to The Guardian, The Independent, The Daily Telegraph, The Daily Express, Le Monde, New Statesman, London Review of Books, Grotta, The Ecologist, The New Internationalist, The Big Issues, The Adbusters, BBC, Radio 4, Radio 2, ITV, and Resonance FM. He's published two works of poetry. He has a trilogy of books titled The Wake, Beast, and the most recent, Alexandria, which came out in 2020. And those are works of fiction, but with sort of like a what if this is what the future looked like sort of, you know, quasi-fiction sort of status. And then this book, Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, came out in 2017. And it's a collection of some of his thoughts in writing from the Dark Mountain Project, as well as new material that was written expressly for this book's theme in order to help tie it all together.
That's cool. I didn't know about his other books. I might want to read those too. That seems neat. The sort of what if.
Yeah. It's like, since you had told me about the one by Starhawk, to read that one. That's kind of maybe, although given Paul Kingsnorth's writing style, his might be a little bit more gloomy.
Well,
but I think it's the same sort of idea of like extrapolating on a what if possible future for mankind. So it's fiction, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be fiction, kind of, in a way, you know.
Yeah, he's got a different tone. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the fifth sacred thing, there's some serious themes in there, and definitely some bad stuff, you know, like just some, but she couches it in a very like gentle manner, and the overarching story is, I don't know, she's got some, it's weird, she makes it like whimsical with like serious, with like sci-fi, with like, I don't know. Anyway, but yeah, I would agree that he would probably have like a different tone. So Arcata is with us tonight as well, as you probably have heard some of her thoughts. If you hear any strange sounds, that's what that is. A brief summary of what the book is about. Paul Kingsnorth was once an activist, an ardent environmentalist. He fought against rampant development and the depredations of a corporate world that seemed hell-bent on ignoring a looming climate crisis in its relentless pursuit of profit. But as the environmental movement began to focus on sustainability rather than the defense of wild places for their own sake, and as global conditions worsened, he grew disenchanted with the movement that he once embraced. He gave up what he saw as the false hope that residents of the first world would ever make the kind of sacrifices that might avert the severe consequences of climate change. Full of grief and fury, as well as passionate, lyrical evocations of nature and the wild, Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist gathers the wave-making essays that have charted the change in Kingsnorth's thinking. In them, he articulates a new vision that he calls dark ecology, which stands firmly in opposition to the belief that technology can save us, and he argues for a renewed balance between the human and non-human worlds. This iconoclastic, featureless, and ultimately hopeful book, which includes the much-discussed Uncivilization Manifesto, asks hard questions about how we've lived and how we should live.
Indeed it does.
Yes, and that Uncivilization Manifesto, it's literally in the back of the book, like right in the back of the book, and I almost missed it.
I think that was what started, like kind of kicked off the Dark Mountain Project, because he penned that and then was like, oh, this could be something, could be representative of something. And then they started that project, which, as far as I'm aware, the Dark Mountain Project is still going, and they have like these annual festivals and stuff.
Oh,
and he just stepped down from heading it in the mid, or I think 2016 or 17 or something, and kind of turned it over to some other people. But the concept of it's still going, which is kind of cool.
That's cool.
That'd be fun to go to.
Yeah.
So, why did we pick this book?
So I want to start out with a tiny quote from him. He says, "Worlds are always ending. That, it turns out, is one of my themes or tics or obsessions." And I just love that. And I was like, yes, that is.
He owns it.
So as soon as I heard about this book, I kind of felt like I had read it. The title says it all. It speaks of the really kind of complex world that we live in. It speaks of a way of thinking that is now needed, that is sort of, it's beyond environmentalism, beyond what has been co-opted by the system that wants to stay the same. It seems like we were like, oh yeah, we've been doing this environmental action thing for a while, and it just sort of seems like it's not working or not working enough. And then like the system that is in charge, in power, they try to sort of use whatever they can to stay in power. And so he has this quote by Wendell Berry. He mentions Wendell Berry a few times in the book, enough where like I actually research Wendell Berry's books and
started one of those?
I did. It's a collection of his essays called The World Ending Fire. And it's very fantastic. He's still writing. He's like in his 80s. So we'll talk more about Wendell Berry, I'm sure, throughout the book, because he does mention him. But I would check Wendell Berry out if you find you love this current book that we're reading, because it's along the same themes. And so he says, you can best serve civilization by being against what usually passes for it. And then here's a quote from Paul Kingsnorth. Worlds are always ending, empires are always falling. The climate has changed before. Change is the only constant. These are the comforting stories we tell to get ourselves through the night. These are the words that allow us to continue to avoid looking at the enormity of what we have done and are doing. They allow us to continue to pretend for a little while longer that the way we are living is right and normal and inevitable, and that it will continue. That these are problems that can be ironed out through the judicious application of our celebrated human cleverness. I love that part. Does anybody really believe this down at the cellular level, down in their gut? Sometimes I think we all know inside, in the place where we are still wild animals, what we have done. Worlds are always ending, it is true, but not like this. This is new. This is bigger than anything there has ever been for as long as humans have existed, and we have done it, and now we're going to have to live through it if we can.
You know, I will say, though, the climate's changed before and change is the only constant and stuff. Comforting stories, yep. But to me, I've kind of found those lines of thinking comforting in the sense that, not that it helps me get through the night and ignore the enormity of what humans are doing to the planet, but in the sense that it lets me think about how, life and things existed before us, and they can certainly have the possibility of evolving and continuing on in some form or shape after us if we, doom ourselves to kingdom come. So in that way, it's this is sounding more like a morbid level of comfort, but what I mean is just that, like, it helps not absolve me or humans of the responsibility, but it at least makes me realize that I don't want to say it's not only on us to fix it, because we've caused the problems, so we ought to do some of the fixing. But let's just say it puts the ball in Mother Nature's court with the level of understanding that's like, okay, even if we try and still mess it up and don't succeed at righting the wrongs, they will get righted, quote unquote, somehow, just by nature's own due course, whatever that might mean. And whether humans are still in the picture or not is, it is what it is. Like, it does, like, it was, it's more comforting to me to just think that
finds a way. Boom. Yeah. Life finds a way.
Life finds a way. Yes, exactly.
Provided we don't blow the planet up. Eventually it'll blow up with the sun. It'll
the inevitable heat death of the universe.
Right, exactly. But it's and so I was listening to the podcast that just came out today. Where we did The Forest Unseen, and the part about how there wasn't oxygen, and that
Oh, yeah.
The creatures existed that didn't breathe oxygen. And oxygen is actually a pollutant. And I feel like that speaks to this issue where, like, even through, like, humans did, as far as I know, didn't cause that shift.
Right.
And life did still persist, but it was very different. So maybe something like that would happen. I think we would be fortunate, I guess, if, you know, we totally messed up and something still lived.
Might be microscopic bacteria, but hey.
Yeah, hey, you know.
In a primordial soup, you know, it's just a little primordial soup seasoning.
And that brings me to this thought that I had about this book. You know, like, I often really like watching disaster movies, like, you know, like the earthquake movies, and like, I love 2012. Even though I don't like horror movies, I watch like The Walking Dead, and I, you know, don't look during the gross parts, and just really kind of just love those movies. Some parts are exciting, but they're also like really scary. Like, I often think, if a disaster hits in real life, could I be the person who would survive, or would I just be the person who was like dead in 5 seconds? Like, just one of the ones who couldn't hack it. Of course, you want to be like the ones who survive, right? But maybe. So there's a scenario about a slow-moving disaster film with a ticking clock counting down. And the main character knows that there's something coming and has a very hard time convincing the people in charge to do anything about it. So in the movie, she would convince everybody. And so, you know, there wouldn't be too much damage done. They would save the world. However, I feel like in real life, the slow clock ticking down is actually climate change.
Yeah.
And the girl screaming at the people in charge are actually like the environmentalists and the other scientists. Because it's weird that, like, the other disasters, like, I think humans haven't known the possible outcome. They're just sort of like Pompeii.
Right.
The volcano. They didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah.
They're just like, do, 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 do. Okay, I'm dead now. But we have, like, the luxury of knowing about this stuff, and we're not, like, you're just like, oh, yeah.
It's sort of like the frog boiling effect, you know. Say, like, if you boil the frog from a cold start, then it doesn't know it's getting boiled alive, you know. That slow motion effect.
Right, you know, so I kind of have that feeling sometimes about what's going on. I think this book talks to that. And even though Paul Kingsnorth has had much different life experiences than me, and he has a much different background, I feel like this book is accessible and very understandable because everybody understands the ideas behind a disaster movie. And I guess one last quote. I see now that the story winding itself through this book is the breaking of the link between people and places, between the past and the present, between instinct and reason, and all the consequences that have ensued and will ensue. I see what is the silencing of what Thomas Berry called the great conversation between humans and the rest of nature, and what this means. This book is about feeling lost and trying to find a way again in a world remaking itself at incredible speed, a world racing away from the real towards artifice and a narrow human narcissism. Our direction of travel is clear, but our destination is not. The old is dead or dying, but the new has yet to be born. At times like these, I'm not sure anyone really has any useful answers, but maybe it's possible at least pin down some useful questions. I've tried to do that here.
You had a few interesting questions in your notes there too about, you know, what do you do if all the screaming in the world won't change anything? And
right. So in my in my scenario about this fake disaster film, I had the thought about what do you do when all the streaming in the world won't change anything? What's next? What do you think about what is behind? What brought us to this point? But it's like about how do you deal with, you know that there's a big problem that needs to be solved. There's something that desperately needs to be addressed, but yet the people in charge who have the power and the position to address it, to solve it, to do something about it, won't do anything. And you're just oh yeah, we'll do this stuff. We'll promise a zero by 2030, zero emissions by 2030. We'll have like 26 years of climate conferences. It just seems like, people have been yelling at the people in charge and they're just sort of like not doing anything and not doing anything. And it's like, well, where does that leave us as, just regular, normal humans who want to live and want the planet to survive? Like, what do you do then? I just listened to an essay by Wendell Berry who talked exactly about this today. And I was like, ah!
Nice.
I have been thinking about power and powerlessness and like when you're powerlessness.
I think something that's, kind of important about all of that, which I just this just now kind of clicked in my head, because I there's sort of an anxiousness or a dis-ease in these sorts of conversations, certainly for most people. Some people won't talk about it at all, like I'm sure Paul Kingsnorth has been a heretic, branded a heretic in more ways than one, and more circles than one, for such thoughts. But some of what it is just that we're in this sort of limbo, or this sort of purgatory, so to speak. No one can predict the future. Of course, no one ever has, in that regard. But like, even best case scenario or worst case scenario, even just with climate, let alone any of the other destructions that we visit on the environment, it's still such a coin toss. But what's important is, like, even though it's unsettling to have to a ask all these questions and not have, we humans, I think by nature, they want to have an answer. It's like, if you're going to ask a question, by golly, you better find the answer, or you better have an answer. And I don't know if some of that comes from the European Puritanism sort of genetics of like, you must work hard all your life until you die, kind of thing, where it's like, everything is ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And so to ask these questions of an open-ended sort of scary abyss, and then to be able to comfortably, for lack of a better term, arguably comfortably sit back and just wait and see without feeling the ego's need to come up with an answer. It's hard. It's really hard.
It's
And
really
that's part of the
hard.
reason why I think this book is pretty amazing for just existing, because he was somebody who was willing to put all that out there and be like, and not just belabor it as a curmudgeon. I'm sure some people would read it as that, but like, if you really read into it, you'll see he's not just somebody who's getting off on complaining about the state of things. He's willing to take it to the next step, which is asking the questions, because if we all start asking these questions and just keep mulling that over in our minds, sooner or later something new could be born of it. So why this book for
Oh
me?
wait, I wanna.
Oh yeah.
I'm raising my hands. I'm gonna see that. So yeah, as I was reading this book, I realized that he just kept asking questions, and that was interesting for me. But also, I have had this experience on a smaller scale in my own life with in regards to the question of what the heck do I do with my life, because I'm 45 and you know, I set out on a path. I wasn't quite sure I had an interest. I had some health issues that really just sort of took me off of any track I was on. And then when I kind of got to a place where, like, okay, now I can think about my future, I was like, well, I'm 45. And this question about should I go back to college has been plaguing me for years. And I haven't known the answer. And I've just, like, stared at the websites of the colleges and been like, what do I want to, what should I study? There's just questions of an open abyss of, like, this question, this big question mark of, like, should I go to college? And then if I should go to college, what the heck do I want to study? Because I'm interested in a whole bunch of other stuff, and I'm interested in a bunch of stuff.
And you're kind of somewhat faced with that whole, you know, like, what do you do in the city when Rome's burning, so to speak, you know, like, you know, people, whether they even want to ever stop and think about it or admit to it or not, we're all caught up in that. How much do we do and hope to do that contributes something good back into the world versus how much is it just like, what can I do for me so that I can at least live a peaceful life for the time that I have, you know?
Right. And that was like, I don't want to lend my talents to the corporate capitalist behemoth that is occurring. So that was a challenge. And I think it's one of the things that maybe had given me pause many years ago when I left the film industry and didn't know what I was going to do. Before I couldn't do anything. So I was, sitting with these questions for a very long time, and it made me very anxious. It made me very anxious and very frustrated because I'm like, I feel so old. I mean, I'm not, but like, when you're thinking about going back to school and starting a career again at my age, it feels... So you're like, well, should I just give it up? Like, there's so many questions. And I did finally find an answer, and it was basically a light bulb moment, which is I decided to go back to school into something that would do both. Contribute to the corporate contribute to, like, things like this podcast and other stuff that I really, you know, so I can do both because I need money to pay the rent.
It's all being the inevitable position we find ourselves in of being caught in the machine, as he refers to so much throughout the book.
Yeah. So maybe the world will have, or someone will have, that light bulb moment about the predicament that we are in. And it's like to some, you know, what I had been telling myself this, all these years, I finally heard in my head. I was like, oh, wait, what the heck is that? Yeah, but it's very unpredictable. It's something that you cannot force. It's just very... So, yeah.
Ask questions, ask them over and over, and sooner or later, hopefully
will come. And try not to beat yourself up too much. But it's
very... That's key.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult.
I actually discovered Paul Kingsnorth sort of by accident. I came across an essay of his published somewhere in an online magazine. I don't even remember what it was. Something environmental related. It actually might have been something in The Ecologist. I didn't know at the time that he was a regular writer for that. But that prompted me to look him up because I liked his writing style. And I don't really know why I chose to start with his book Savage Gods first. I think it's because I wasn't in the mood to read fiction, and I was looking for something more than just poetry. Anyway, the writing style is so gripping and moving in that book that I laid on the couch and read it cover to cover in a single day. And Then I was curious about his other writings, and well, I mean, you can't deny that the title of this one is certainly eye-catching. So that was my next feast of his writings, and every bit has been just as page-turning as I found Savage Gods to be. Only in Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, I find he's saying a lot of things that people might think and feel, myself included, but either lack the right words to have explained it or just wouldn't dare to. And it's a very pressing matter for our times, for our species and the planet. And as dim and defeated as one might could think the work is based on the title or some of its content, it's actually very worth pressing on through it, as I said earlier, because if you come out the other side, hopefully you can walk away at least with some refreshed perspective and a little humility. And I think we're in a position right now on a globalization level where a little humility would go a long way.
I think he's got a lot of humor that he adds to the book, even though it's very serious, but it's
dark humor.
Yeah, it's witty. It's very, it's like, it goes down smooth. I don't know. It's not hard to listen, read. It's accessible in that respect. So I really like how he puts things. Like I said, the ideas in this book are pretty complex, and he mostly writes about the ideas that have made like a personal impact in his life, and he writes on the level of personal, and that makes everything both more relatable and understandable.
Yeah, I agree. I think the approachability is important when tackling tough subject material like that, because I mean, it could be a bitter pill to swallow. And I mean, he doesn't sugarcoat it by any means, but he's at least sort of trying to hold the hand of mm-hmm. those who are willing to hear him out. I mean, I appreciate that the book takes time to build his case, and he's self-reflecting enough to show the reader how and why he came to the terms of identifying himself as a recovering environmentalist. So he's not just like willy-nilly throwing these terms out and, you know, with just an angry chip on his shoulder and no logic behind it, you know what I mean?
So this is what we like least about this book, and I never could figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I mean, the only thing I could think is, I think we can all agree, I mean, no doubt Paul himself would probably agree, that we just wish such things didn't even have to be written or said, you know? It isn't easy muck to wade through. It's heart-wrenching. And so I don't like that the book had to be written.
Yeah.
Sure, he very much doesn't like that either.
And unfortunately, all the ideas are still, is it the word prescient?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the right word? Today, yeah. So it's, I mean, he's writing in like 2011, 2016, like it's
right, like, and it's like the blink of an eye, right?
It's like, oh well, this he wrote, unless he's talking about the World Trade Center, you know, 9/11, which he does in a chapter we're not covering today, I believe. Yeah. So it's mostly things that are extremely still relevant, and it kind of sucks. I was like, oh, I wish this book was outdated completely. And we're like, yeah, we're glad we can move past that. We're done. Did such a good job.
What's some of the stuff you'd say you learned from reading the book? Like some takeaways so far?
I think that one of the biggest ones is that there's still hope. And even if we never find the answer, the right questions might be even more important, and which is what we talked about. And also that going to space to live on Mars is not the answer.
Should have a recurring theme through a few episodes too.
It is. So I'm going to read you some quotes from that because
they're good.
They're good. And when it calls back to when we read Biophilia, I can't remember which episode that is, but if we've mentioned it on this podcast, we mentioned it during The Forest Unseen. I feel like there's a few themes that run through some of these books we seem to be reading lately. Here we go. I'm referring to the human colonization of other worlds. It seems eccentric even to write the words, but there's no doubt that a belief in humanity's need, perhaps its destiny, to colonize the moon or Mars or other worlds known or unknown, is making a strange kind of cultural comeback, no matter that it is no more practical now than it was in the 1950s, no matter that it doesn't look likely that it could happen within the lifetime of anyone alive today, if ever. The particularities are not the point. It is a fantasy, a motif, the means of salvation. The solution? Not to change ourselves, but to find another planet on which to replay the same script. And this is in reference to us sort of trashing up Earth and then moving on. If we begin to shift people off world, we will have new frontiers to explore. The pressure on Earth will be reduced. We will be saved by our cleverness from the consequences of our cleverness.
Yeah, he writes a lot of statements like that that are kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Which I find funny. If we were to colonize a dead planet like Mars, we would somehow need to make up 75% on our own, working it up from a world of dead rock and dust. How would we do it? We have no idea. In all likelihood, it would be entirely impossible. The purpose of delusions is to comfort us, and our space-age delusions comfort us on a cultural level. The best way around them is probably to examine our own mental maps and thus our own minds and try to deflect them as they come. This is the work of a lifetime, but perhaps in the end, it is the only work. So if we believe in progress, we will believe in progress. If we need to believe in apocalypse, we will believe in that. If we need to deny the existence of climate change or believe we can go back to the Pleistocene or forward to the Martian future, we'll believe those things as long as we want to believe them. Nothing can tear those maps from our hands. The purpose of delusion is to comfort us. And our space age delusions comfort us on a cultural level. The best way around them is probably to examine our own mental maps and thus our own minds and try to reflect them as they come. This is the work of a lifetime, but perhaps in the end, it is the only work. All that we are, explained the Buddha 2,500 years ago, is a result of what we have thought. The mind is everything. What we think we become. What we can see that our civilization is becoming, and where is it going? What delusions brought us here, and how can we begin to strip them away?
I'm still working my way through the book. It's been taking longer to read things these days with a newborn in the house. I can't lay on the couch and read all day. But so far, it's definitely been a valuable takeaway to find that his words are validation to me in some way. That, like, I'm not crazy or utterly defeatist to even have thought or felt a lot of the things that he expresses in this book. The book also shows me the importance of grief work over the situation that we find ourselves in and the planet in at this point. I mean, it certainly gives me a lot of pause in terms of things to think about and even things to plan to teach my daughter, you know, like, hey, kid, here's the world you're inheriting. A quote I pulled out on that note, and interestingly, with the chosen word, biophilia. He says, the increasingly fashionable word biophilia seems to me to be simply a modern science-sanctioned way of describing an ancient kind of love, the love for the natural world of which we are part. Nature is not something external to us. It's something we are part of and something that is within us. It's what we are. What are we if not natural? Biophilia, then, love of life, is as natural as the love of your wife or husband or children or parents. Your relationship with nature may sometimes be as difficult and stormy as your relationship with any of them, but none of these relationships can go away, and they will change you. We're all bound up together. Watch any child play in a field, and they would know this. Then they, we, grow up and we learn to convince ourselves that objective reality is somehow different from lived experience. We learn to convince ourselves that the world is a machine, not an animal, that it's unconscious and meaningless, and that the only questions to be asked are questions of how and not questions of why or whether. However we got here, we have managed to create a culture in which we have alienated ourselves from the rest of life. We struggle to persuade ourselves this alienation is the same thing as freedom. Increasingly, though, for those pinned into cities with no view of the stars and no taste of clean air and nothing but grass between cracks and pavement to nourish their sense of the wild, this is no freedom at all. We've made ourselves caged animals, and all the gadgets in the world cannot compensate for what we have lost. And he goes on to say, but in the decline of one age and one way of seeing, there is always containing the seed of another. If an unexamined yearning to reconnect with the wild world remains within us, then perhaps we will never quite allow ourselves to be tamed. It is a delicious thought that what might save us in the end will not be a new economic arrangement or a new politics or another revolution or a series of wonder technologies, but our own inner wildness, pushed under so hard for so long that it finally bursts to the surface again, hungry for what it has lost.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes.
It's like the soul yearning deep down of like, but wait, remember who you are. And I've read a lot of people writing in this vein. Another author I really like, sort of a poetic musing person along these veins, is Martin Shaw. And he had just had a book come out kind of in the middle of the pandemic called The Smoke Hole. Something about the smoke hole. But anyway, it's very much digging into that theme as well, about like, you know, we need to have a new way of telling our stories in order to shift where we're at. It's big thoughts.
I was just trying to find the book, but I could not. Wait. Yes, Smoke Hole, Looking to the Wild in the Time of the Spyglass.
Yeah, that's
the one. Oh, it's got an Audible. Unabridged, nice.
And actually, it also makes me think about a book I read a long time ago called Beyond Civilization by Daniel Quinn. And I know Paul Kingsmore has quoted Daniel Quinn sometimes. I don't remember if it was in this book or if it was in some of his essays I was reading recently where he did a Daniel Quinn quote. But I've always liked this one point that Daniel Quinn said, where he said, the world won't be saved by old minds coming up with new programs. It'll be new minds with no programs at all. And that's kind of go lock and step with a lot of the points that Paul Kingsnorth is making, where it's like, we can't just keep doing these same things, these same politicking arguments and these same protests and expect different results. Like, it all has to be raised, you know, from the ground up, pretty much.
It's just so hard to untangle that programming, and
how do you come up with something completely new? Because almost everything something, you know, but we're at a point where we really need to start having some new ideas.
I mean, I agree, but I also agree that they're not going to come from something completely new. They're going to be kind of we're going to have to pull them from something in our experiences, because that's all our experiences. So it's going to have a seed of, like you're talking about, the seed of the new in the old. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think about. Like, there's some kernel of something that we need to find and pull it out and blow it up. And but it's hard because we're so immersed in the old way, or
more relatively new way, if you're thinking of like industrialization and all of that. But in that regard, it's kind of like humans have the hindsight of a fruit fly. I mean, not really, not as bad as that, but I mean, relative to what humans have accomplished in all of the time that we've existed, our memories and actions seem to suggest that our attention span memory level is that of a fruit fly, and it really shouldn't be, you know.
When I was really listening to Wendell Berry today, and he was talking about the farming, the family farms disappearing, and this is in like the 70s. He's writing this in the 70s. He's like, for anybody who is alive now, who, like, the people are dying or disappearing that would be able to see what's going on with the farm and the landscape because they were alive before. But all the new people, they can't see it because this is their experience. Like, they can't.
Basically,
I'm not explaining that.
More poetic way of saying how history can be doomed to repeat itself if you don't know your history.
Right, exactly. Like, people, like the old farmers were were getting older and dying, and then their kids were not taking up the family farm, so that they were losing all this knowledge that had been passed along to the generation, and with it the ability to see what we were doing to the land in comparison to how it was in the past, to how it was.
Yeah. Well, who would you recommend this book for?
I would recommend it for anyone who loves disaster movies, and anyone who's looking for a way to think about what's happening to our planet.
I'd say technically any human being living in any semblance of a westernized, industrialized, quote-unquote modern world really ought to read it. Even if it's not somebody's typically preferred type and genre of reading material. Because it's not about the read, it's about the message therein. And certainly anybody who has already had these big feelings regarding the failure of movements and humans' devastation on our home planet would hopefully find a kindred and maybe a little solace in reading it as well.
I want to say this thing about grief, go back to that statement about the what you're talking about grief. And I just, I definitely like feel that. It's just sad.
And if you think about, like, what I remember the proper order, but, you know, the stages of grief being like anger and denial and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, well, that's about where we're at collectively right now. And, but we have to get through all the stages to heal. Right. You know, like, and the sooner the better, but
it's sad. It's sad. I saw another bear in the parking lot at acupuncture yesterday for our bear discussion last podcast. Which I love seeing them, but I hate why I see them.
Yeah.
So I love seeing the bears, and we saw a deer cross the highway when I had to go to overtime one Saturday morning as well. I love watching the animals, and I love watching the big crows at lunch just sort of car, they just fly around, and they're real loud and big right now because, I don't know, winter time, they're out there. All right, tangent. So we have some quotes that we pulled from the section of the book that we read, the first, pretty much it's divided, the book is divided into three sections. So we just took the first one, and I really, really wanted to quote the whole book, but,
yeah, it's hard.
It was really hard. And sometimes I have a hard time. What?
I said, just go read it.
Just go read it. You should see my notes. It's like this whole paragraph. And this whole paragraph is I just was like, oh, this is good. Wait, this is good too. I have a hard time pulling out sometimes the most important parts of something. I've gotten better over the years, but.
Well, it's what grabs you, what moves you. Right. I find it interesting, though, comparing our notes and seeing how we pretty much have picked a lot of the same material as quote worthy. So,
yeah, that's cool.
That says anything about either great minds or just the potency of the material.
I'm going to go with great minds. So I've got two, and they're both not from King's North, but he does quote other people in this book, and he has some good ones. So the first one is to function effectively in an environment that precludes everything vital and human is the key to modern life. And that's David Foster Wallace. And I loved this one because it describes how I feel about the life that I am currently living. If I just ignore everything and continue on with what I'm doing.
Like modern life is really asking people to, not asking, demanding people in touch with themselves.
Yes.
I mean, it's the only way it keeps rolling.
Right. You work in a factory, you work doing something, I don't know, even like customer service, or you're a cashier or something. You're just asked to do repetitive things over and over every day. And I think that I hate that. And I think that most humans do not like that. So I feel like humans are very creative, and it just sort of like, does not
eaten out of us.
Yeah. And it doesn't acknowledge it. It doesn't use it it just throws that out the window.
So it's not usually given the opportunity to be exercised usually in those sorts of environments.
Oh, right. You're asked to basically be a robot, which humans are not a robot. It's an antithesis
to the book.
Right, it's antithesis to our nature. So the next quote is from the essay The Drowned World. The story is always the same. An expanding economy needs water or electric power or both. Dams and reservoirs are planned in the interest of national development and economic competitiveness. Villagers whose lifestyle are genuinely low impact and sustainable are barged out of the way, often in the most horrific circumstances, by a metastasizing urban culture that claims to want to be both of these things, but is not willing to pay the hard price. The city eats the country. The line from the authorities is always the same too. This is for everyone's benefit. The reality is usually different. The power and the pipe water go to the industrial areas, the cities, the rich suburbs. The refugees from the country go to the slums. Who notices? Who reports it? A few journalists and campaigners, but most of us never hear of these things or care if we do. This is a little story that he told, a true story about to power another big town. They dammed up another small village in a valley. So they drowned it. And he said because of like climate change and I think water level, it went down enough where you could see like the bones of this, the structures of the buildings of the town and everything else. But it's like this idea that the countryside is not as valuable as the city, which is kind of silly because one probably needs the country more. But I think they're both important.
I like this quote from his essay, A Crisis of Bigness. He's speaking about a writer named Leopold Kohr, which I had never heard of until his mention of him, but now I want to look up his works too. But he says, the most interesting political thinker that you have never heard of, saying that his ideas got ignored because they just don't flatter the egos of the power hungry, but they, be they the revolutionaries or the plutocrats. Kohr was a student of economics and political theory who lived through several world-defining moments in human history. In 1957, he wrote his first book called The Breakdown of Nations and laid out what at the time was a radical case that small states, small nations, and small economies are more peaceful, more prosperous, and more creative than great powers and superstates. Kohr's claim was that society's problems were not caused by particular forms of social or economic organization, but by their size. Socialism, capitalism, democracy, monarchy, all could work well on what he called the human scale, a scale at which people can play a part in the systems that govern their lives. But once it scaled up to a level of modern states, then all the systems became oppressors. Changing the system or the ideology that it claimed inspiration from would not prevent any oppression, as any number of revolutions have shown us, because the problem is not the thing that is big, but bigness itself. Drawing from history, Kohr demonstrated that when people have too much power under any system, or none at all, they abuse it. The task, therefore, was to limit the amount of power that any individual, organization, or government could get its hands on. And he goes on to say, we've now reached the point that Kohr warned us of over half a century ago, the point where instead of growth serving life, life must now serve growth, perverting the very purpose of its existence. And if that doesn't explain our current
situation,
industrialized state, I don't know what does.
So, I mean, I agree with him, except that I feel like even a small capitalism and a small monarchy still function similarly. Like, capitalism is still going to be exploitative even when it's small. This is from the Quats and the Poets. The male geeks who now run the futures and operations in banking are known as Quats. One MBA student quoted in the book reported that on his course, the students were required to identify themselves as either Quats or Poets. Do they do numbers or do they do words? And I added that part because it helps explain the next quote.
Oh, okay.
Too many green Quats, then, and not enough green Poets? I think so. Or rather, I think that the Poets have been cowed into silence by the dominance and urgency of the Quats narrative. How to reassess the importance of story, then? Or perhaps a key question now, green Poets might perhaps start by observing that worlds are not saved by the same stories that are killing them. They might want to observe that saving worlds is an impossible business in the first place, or they might try to explore what it is about how we see ourselves that reduces us to this time and time again, arguing about machines rather than wondering what those machines give us and what they take away. The part that I really thought was cool was that when he says stories, worlds are not saved by the same stories that are killing us.
Yeah.
Which means that they're saved by different stories. So we have to make different stories.
Change the narrative of what we're trying to live by. Yeah.
Yeah. And who we are.
Get everybody on board. I pulled out a couple other quotes relating to space race stuff we were talking about. The essay or that chapter section was called The Space Race is Over. So more on those thoughts. It didn't take long for the optimism of the space race to abate. And for a few decades, the idea seemed to disappear from the popular consciousness. But I've noticed that in the last few years, the old promises resurfaced into the popular consciousness. And this time around, it has a different taste to it. This time around, it seems more like a threat. Today, the world is a different place. The popular faith in science and technology has drained away to be replaced by a widespread, if often unspoken, fear. From biotechnology to geoengineering, from Reaper drones to internet surveillance, the democratic promise of technology has been transmuted into authoritarian threats. Meanwhile, the vision of science-fueled progress has done as much damage as it has offered improvements. With the climate changing, with the sixth mass extinction well underway, with the ocean swimming in our industrial refuse, with our own chemical backwash in breast milk and bloodstreams, it's a harder world for techno-optimists to find a voice. We've opened the box and seen where our ambition leads, and though we might quickly close it again and look away, it is too late in the day for any kind of innocence. And he sums things up saying, I think it's precisely this fear of the future, this feeling that we have unleashed a monster that's now beyond our control, that has given rise to the latest cultural outburst about the colonization of other worlds. This time the idea isn't buoyed on a tide of optimism and hope, but tinged with desperation, sadness, and sometimes even anger. This time it's not our next exciting adventure, but it's our final hope. And in that context, he's not saying it is our final hope. He's saying that's how people are treating it, you know, like that's the last ditch effort. Hurry, get us off this crazy planet.
Right. Like, and it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, 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 whoa. It doesn't make any sense. It's like moving to another town to start over after but you didn't have any, like, you didn't go to any counseling to, like, stop.
Right.
You know, like, maybe you murdered a few.
They're probably going to follow you.
Yeah, your problems are going to follow you. Like, oh, let's see. You murdered a few people in that town, moving to another town, not going to change things, right? That's an extreme example. But so our last quote is from A Short History of Loss. How do we get to the point where we regard a living creature as a robot and an inefficient one at that? Write for replacement with better models once we have worked out how to make them. What errors have led us to this way of seeing? Were they the same errors that got us to the point where we were both willing and able to spray landscapes with toxic pesticides that wiped out vast swaths of insect life? Were they the same errors that could change the climate of an entire planet, trigger a sixth mass extinction event, acidify oceans, break up the ice caps, and shred the last great wild forests and their inhabitants in the cause of toilet paper and soya mints? That's right. I agree.
It sounds like she was asking a question.
Probably like, that is a sad quote to end on.
Well, I think it was a good way to end this episode, that we can leave that as the final quote, as a thought to ponder before we dig further into where the story leads, coming up in part two, review of Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist by Paul Kingsnorth. Because that's kind of how the book goes. It like builds it all up. It starts asking all the questions, and then we'll see where it leads.
Yes, and this one he was talking about beforehand, that they had made robot insects.
Yeah, like bees and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I want to thank everyone for listening. Paul Kingsnorth has a Substack, and I'll put the links to that as well if you want to check that out.
And he's got a website where you can
he has a website.
Read some of his writings and stuff on there too.
Yes. Yes. And you can follow us on Anchor and Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. We have a Facebook group, and all the links will be in the description. If you'd like to support us, you can do so through our Anchor page at $1, $5, or $10 a month. You can also leave us you can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Yeah, so we have At this time, we don't know what our next episode is going to be.
We've got a couple ideas in the works, and we're seeing which will pan out first.
Right.
It might be part two of this book review.
It might be. Yes, thank you for, bearing with us through some baby noises. And please watch us on YouTube. You can currently see the cute baby.
He wants to be interviewed on the podcast.
Well, I mean, yes. Oh. Oh, are you okay? That sounds. She always looks like
too much slobber.
Frowning.
She furrows her brow a lot like I do when she's lost in thought.
Oh. All right. Well, I can't wait for her to be a little older so we can hear all this.
And then we will interview her. Tell us, what do you think about these problems you're inheriting?
And then she'll be like, Mom, I don't want to be on your dumb podcast. I want to do cool things. All right. Okay, guys. Well, enough of that. We'll
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye for now.